Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 33. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. As always, I'd like to begin by thanking the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. A huge thank you to Andy, Joanna, Christina, Sharon, Jenny, Julie, Noel, and Raluca. Thank you so much, Dawn, Daniel, Leslie, Katie, Jenny, Shah, Beth, and Carol. Much gratitude to Caroline, Sally, Haynes, Stephanie, Stacy, Callan, Marcus, and Lauren. A big thank you to Denise, Can, Sandy, James, Jenna, Leah, and Jenna. Thank you very much, Milena, Taylor, Katie, Sahara, Antonio, Diane, Isabel, Jennifer, and Carla. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before the end of May, and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. This month's prize is a copy of In the Footsteps of the Six Wives of Henry VIII, co-authored by Sarah Morris and myself, plus two fabulous digital mini-guides from the TudorTravelGuide.com, one from their Tudor Day Out collection and another from their Tudor Weekend Away range. A huge thank you to Sarah Morris, aka the Tudor Travel Guide, for sponsoring this amazing prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm delighted that joining me on the show to talk about Henry VIII's jousting and masculinity is Emma Levitt. Emma is a PhD history graduate of the University of Huddersfield. Her research into English jousting tournaments and representations of masculinity mainly focuses on the reigns of Edward IV and Henry VIII. For this original research, Emma was the recipient of the Richard III Society Prize in 2014. Emma has also published articles in BBC History magazine, How Jousting Made a Man of Henry VIII, and in History Today, Woodville versus the Bastard. Emma has forthcoming publications due out this year and next on Edward IV's tiltyard friendships and a chapter on the significance of sporting displays in medieval European cultural history. My conversation with Emma straight after this musical break, courtesy of Transept, a wonderful vocal ensemble based in South Dakota. Huge thank you to Tim Campbell, their artistic director, for providing me with this live recording from a concert they performed last September entitled The Tudors, Monarchy, Drama and the Music of Celestial Harmony. Visit www.transept.org to find out more about this group.
Thank you.
Welcome to Talking Tutors, Emma. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to chatting today. I'd love to begin by you just telling us a little bit about yourself, a bit about your background, please.
Yeah, so I come from a little seaside town on the East Yorkshire coast called Bridlington. Mm-hmm. And I've always been interested in history. And we spent lots of days out as a family visiting English castles and heritage sites. And I've always just been really interested by how people lived in the past.
Yes.
So history was my favourite subject at school. And in particular, I really always loved learning about kings and queens. And this has developed across being at school and college. And then I went to university to study history in Huddersfield. And I really just enjoyed the time that I had there. I looked at early modern history in particular and was always really fascinated by Tudor history.
Right.
And this led me to spend about a decade at Huddersfield, actually, doing my master's and my doctorate there as well.
Fabulous. So was it a particular person that drew you into Tudor history, or was it more just the whole period you found intriguing?
For me, being at primary school, I was really fascinated by Henry VIII in particular. I think just learning about all the different wives that he had, the big changes that take place during his reign with religion, with the Tudor court and politics. It was just an exciting period for me to get my teeth into. And in particular, jousting contests. I'd been to jousting contests as quite a young child and was just always enthralled by the knights and this medieval world that was so different to the world that we live in today.
Absolutely, yes. I saw some jousting done at a medieval fair here, and it was really amazing to see it up close in person. It's quite amazing.
Definitely.
All right, fabulous. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about medieval tournaments. Now, we know that Henry VIII was a sort of good all-round sportsman and that he did hold many tournaments during his reign. Could you talk to us about what tournaments actually were and what the different forms of competition involved?
Yeah, so early tournaments were more of a mock battle or a melee.
Right.
So these were not formalised or even confined to the tournament field. Knights would actually be assigned to two opposing teams and they would charge at each other on a given signal. So this was a practice that was not really too dissimilar to medieval warfare. In a melee tournament, it would have taken place over a vast area and it would have been very difficult to gauge accurately the individual performance of men. Mm. And these were very dangerous. There was a real threat of death or injury. And these could involve thousands or even hundreds of knights as well. They were very popular. Yeah, they were very popular in the 12th century. They declined by the middle of the 14th century, and they become superseded by other forms of combat by the 15th century.
Right. Okay.
By the 15th century, the tournament assumes a more of a complex form. So now we have three distinct forms of combat.
Mm-hmm.
We have jousting.
Yep.
We have the tourney, and we have the fighting on foot or combat on foot. If we start with a joust, this is fought between two individuals.
Mm-hmm.
The knights would ride from opposite ends of the lists and they would encounter each other with lances. There was also subcategories of the joust. So you have a joust of war, and that's with sharp lances. And you have a joust of peace, and that's with blunted lances.
Right, okay.
You would also have two different types of teams. So you have the challengers, and this is usually about 4 to 6 knights, and they would challenge all competitors. Or you might get individual knights who would wage a direct challenge with an adversary. Now, your opponent team is known as the answerers, and they would decide to answer this challenge, so hence the name answerers.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal in the early contest in the 13th century, when the joust is really the high point of the tournament, is to knock the opponent completely out of his saddle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an extremely dangerous sport at this stage, because there's still no tilt barrier that we see today to separate the contestants. You really had to be quite a skilled horseman, because there was really nothing to prevent horses from crashing into each other. By the sort of second stage of the tournament, I guess, this is taken from the Malay. This is a tourney, and this involves teams of knights. And this was, again, a mounted combat. It would be with blunted swords, generally. And, again, you would fight in teams, and the number of strokes you delivered would determine the number of scores. Right, the final stage was the foot combat, and this is just referred to a single combat on foot with spears or axes or swords, and this would be over a barrier. So by the end of the 15th century, actually the tournament really does evolve to be quite a vigorous sporting competition that has these three stages of contest with men challenging both on horseback and on foot.
Well, that sounds amazing. I didn't realise there was so much to it, to be honest. And so would a person have, so if you're entering, do you need to enter all three of those competitions, or could you just joust and not be in the tourney?
Yeah, so you can just pick and choose, I guess. Everyone wants to compete in the joust. That is the high point of the competition. Just thinking now, actually, about Knight's Tale, if you've seen that film.
Yes.
You can see that he really wants to compete in the joust because that's the big contest that he wants to get into.
Right.
And although he's quite skilled in the foot combat, he decides to concentrate all his efforts into the joust. So joust was really the high point. It was probably the contest that also involved the most sort of elaborate gifts as well and prizes. Right, and of course, the most manly prestige.
Fascinating stuff. I love it. All right. So Emma, you've mentioned obviously that the tournament evolved over the centuries and changed. So what was it like under Henry VIII? Was it these three that you've just specified then?
Yeah, so under Henry VIII, the tournament really becomes a large public spectacle. Mm-hmm. So we have thousands of spectators that pack themselves into tiered viewing stands. And this is to get a glimpse of the sporting elite of the Tudor court. So I guess the modern day equivalent would be going to watch a Premier League football match, if you will, and trying to get a capture the football players that you are supporting as a fan. Now, Henry favoured a variant form of the joust, which was a joust royal. Right. And this is very similar to the joust of peace that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. But they're quite different because now we have the added extra of the tilt barrier.
Right, okay.
So you would joust over the barrier, and now there were tournament horses that were specifically trained for the joust. Uh-huh. So under Henry, it becomes much more of an elaborate occasion. You have knights that will parade down the lists in quite fantastical costumes and armour, and you have these magnificent horses that are decorated. And the tilt yard still becomes a very important arena for Henry to really showcase his kingship and his manliness. But it's definitely the joust that is the high point, and now it's much more formalised in terms of the competition, in terms of the rules, and also the prizes that are given. And these might include anything from a trained falcon to a diamond ring or a ruby ring. Wow. Or a gold chain, something that could be worn, that you could show off that you had won in a tournament.
How fabulous. Wouldn't it have been wonderful to see one of those amazing spectacles in person? Would have been amazing. And obviously several sort of paintings and portraits spring into my mind as you're describing, I think, one of Catherine in the stands watching Henry joust after the birth of their son just sort of popped into my mind as you were talking there. Now, you mentioned the scoring. So who actually did the scoring? I'd love to hear a little bit more about how these events were actually scored.
Yes, I think it is something that a lot of us don't actually realise, that it wasn't just a case of simply knocking your opponent off his saddle. Mm-hmm. By the 15th and 16th century, there really was a scoring system. So it was actually Henry's grandfather, Edward IV, who wanted to revive chivalry and tournaments in England. And he himself was a keen jouster. Mm. And we know that he was even taller than Henry, so he was about 6'4". Strapping young man. And it was a constable of England, a man called John Tiptoff, Earl of Worcester, who in 1466 was asked by Edward to come up with a scoring system and a set of rules for jousting across a barrier. And this is being introduced in the 15th century, this barrier. So according to Tiptoff, if you broke a spear on the body of your opponent,
right,
that would count for 1 point.
Mm-hmm.
And if you broke a spear on the head, which is obviously a much more difficult target to hit,
yep,
that would be 2 points. If you broke your spear coronel to coronel, or the tip of the lance to tip of the lance, mm-hmm, that would count 3. If you hit your opponent but the lance didn't actually shatter, that was less than a point. So these scores would have been tallied across the full day of the competition.
Right, okay.
And generally lead to two winners, one for the challengers and one for the answerers. And, you know, perhaps we can even imagine that it was recorded and ranked in a table, you know, comparable to modern sports leagues. But what is interesting, it does create this practice that, you know, arguably is completely objective. So it's based on a knight's ability to score the most points, which is achieved by breaking the most spears.
Right, okay.
And what I found quite interesting was that actually no jousters ever really contest these scores that are awarded to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it does suggest that they really trusted this system to judge them quite objectively based on their abilities. So it's not just a case of, oh, Henry won because he was king and that's his status. Actually, there is a definite scoring system in place. Although, you know, perhaps some men may have manipulated the scores,
okay,
but we can discuss that a little bit later.
All right, fabulous. Yes, I know, because obviously Henry was said to be very good, and I often wonder, was he very good, or was he,
yes,
you know, was it just that people were letting him win? Now, so we know that Henry was a very keen and talented juster. And presumably, after everything you're saying and all these different ways of scoring, you learnt the rules at a very young age, I'm imagining. So what were the rules when Henry was being taught how to joust and all the rules? What would he have been taught specifically? Do we know what sort of rules he would have started with?
It would have been Tiptoff's rules that are a part of this scoring system as well.
Mm-hmm.
So as well as gaining points, you could lose points as well. So points would be lost if you struck a man below the waist, if you struck his saddle.
Okay.
So you weren't allowed to do that. So you could lose a point for that. Also, if you hit the tilt barrier, you would lose a point.
Mm.
And if you hit it twice, you would lose 3 points. If you also struck a horse, you would also lose a point as well. So there definitely were instances where men would incur fouls. They were very, in particular, precious about their horses, which was quite rightly, if you have a trained tournament horse, you do want to ensure its safety. But we know that Henry, in particular, was using these rules in his reign, because we have one surviving challenge that I'll move on to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And in this tournament challenge, it sets out what all the rules are for that particular tournament. And when you look at that challenge, and I haven't actually studied it myself,
yeah,
the rules that are in there are those that relate to Tiptoff.
Right,
so
okay.
Clearly, these rules were being used and had become common practice by the early 16th century, all the way back from 1466.
Right, okay. Now, I'm glad you mentioned the tournament challenge, because I was going to ask you, I'd love to know, what are some of the main surviving sources of information that we have that tells us about the tournaments and the jousting?
So there are a few examples that we have, which are really exciting to look at. In particular, very colourful, illuminated manuscripts that survive. And one of them is the Westminster Tournament Challenge.
Right.
And this is actually held in the British Library in London. And it's written on a single parchment. It's quite a large tournament challenge in terms of its presentation. And I believe this is because it was presented at quite a major tournament in Henry's reign. So I'll move on to talk about the Westminster Tournament.
Okay.
But it was how to celebrate the birth of Henry's heir. So this is perhaps why it was kept.
Right, okay.
We don't actually have any other original surviving challenges that survived from this period, unfortunately. But this one's a really good example, because you have the signature of both Henry and all his knights that
oh,
took
wow.
part. And this would have been passed round the knights, and they would have to sign their names to agree to the rules and the different challenges that were going to be a part of this tournament. It's also got quite a prominent fold line in it, which suggests that it was stored away, maybe kept safe by a herald. So that's a really richly decorated piece that is the exception. We also have about half a dozen surviving score checks from Henry's reign. And these are held in the College of Arms in London. And these are really incredible to look at. So it takes the form of a rectangular.
Right.
And you have three horizontal lines. Now, the middle line shows hits that are made on the body.
Mm-hmm.
And the top line shows hits that were made on the head. The bottom line shows any fouls that were incurred, such as striking the horse. And then you have a long line running through at the centre, which is tallied for the number of courses that they run. So how many matches effectively they play. So usually anywhere between about 2 and 8 runs up and down the tilt. So we have a few of those that survive. And we also have, as you mentioned a little bit earlier on, this huge great tournament roll held in the College of Arms.
Mm-hmm.
And this vividly depicts the proceedings of the 1511 Westminster tournament as well. So it's a painted roll of vellum, and it's a real visual representation of the Tudor tournament as a spectacle. So it's about 60 feet long and about 14 inches wide. So it's incredible that we have that, because as you said, one of the middle membranes shows Henry competing in a joust with Catherine of Aragon and the ladies watching over at this spectacle.
Yes, it's beautiful. It's amazing. I think you can see it online just for our listeners, and I'll try and find it and put a link in our show notes, because it is an amazing, amazing document, isn't it? Just going back to the score checks that you mentioned, I actually don't think I've ever seen one. I'm trying to think. So in terms of who was doing the marking and the scoring, was that somebody's particular job, or is that, do we have any information about that?
Yes, so we have lots of manuscripts that have been recorded by heralds,
right.
And it was heralds that were assigned the task of scoring the joust. So you might have had one herald who was scoring all the challenges,
mm-hmm.
and then another herald who was scoring all the answers. So they kept note of the scores, and they were really the best people to do this, because they were recording all the knights' names and shields. So they were aware of who it was that was playing. So yes, so they have kept lots of these records. And we also have lots of heraldic volumes that contain narratives of jousting tournaments, of score checks, of rules. It's almost as they've compiled all this information together and kept it as a bit of a working document for themselves. And in particular, Tiptoft rules are held in about 12 of these different surviving heraldic volumes. And you can find these in the British Library and the Royal College of Arms. So they were definitely a working document for heralds.
How wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Now, you mentioned the dangers involved. It sounds like, and we know that there were several accidents, and we'll talk about those a little bit later. But Henry obviously loved vigorous sport. You know, he loved hunting and tennis and anything, really. Why else, apart from his love of sport, would he have chosen to hold and participate in these tournaments, especially considering the dangers involved?
I think that is a really interesting point. So we have examples of tournaments being held across the medieval period. We have them in the reign of Richard II, Henry IV, Henry VII even, but we don't have these kings participating. And I think for Henry's really keen at the start of his reign to establish himself as a very different type of king to his father. And Henry's father had to win his throne on the battlefield at Bosworth. And Henry inherits his throne. So I think a lot of this is Henry's way to prove his kingship, mm-hmm. his martial abilities, and his manhood from the very start of his reign. And so Henry throws himself into the tournament field. We know it is a very dangerous sport, and we know it's still being used as a means of military training. So until Henry goes off to fight war with France, the tournament is an important arena for him to showcase his manliness and also his skills as a warrior. And Henry really looks back to these medieval kings. We know that Henry V is his hero. Also, to some extent, Edward IV, his grandfather, who also competed in in tournaments. And so I think, you know, these are real models of Henry, of the type of king that he wants to be. And he definitely saw himself as a medieval knight. And it's also a way, of course, for him to really get validation for his manhood, because, as you said, we have the women that are watching at the court, we have men that are watching, and it also enables him to develop quite strong bonds with the men in the tilt yard, because he really has to trust these men not to kill him.
Yes, exactly.
So he does develop strong friendships as well.
It makes perfect sense, doesn't it, when you think about the fact that obviously, yeah, his father won it on a battlefield. Like, he displayed his masculinity for everyone to see. And so, you know, this is Henry's way of showing that he's also just as masculine, if not more, than his dad.
Yeah.
So interesting. All right. Well, I've seen all of Henry's surviving jousting armor. And obviously what is immediately obvious is how trim he was and how fit he must have been in his early years compared to obviously later in his reign. So could you talk to us a little bit about Henry's physique and the training regime that he must have been involved in these early days?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the Henry that we all think of that comes to mind is that Holbein image where he is a larger-than-life character. But actually, Henry as a young man, like you say, was very athletic, very muscular. And this is a product of the amount of training that would be involved in jousting tournaments. As I've mentioned, it isn't just a matter of running down the tilt yard and fighting the opponent and knocking him out of his saddle. There is quite a serious practice involved. I mean, it is very technical. So one of the things that young Tudor knights would do, and Henry himself as well, is to run at the tilt or the ring.
Yes.
And this involves a competitor who would attempt to strike an object with his lance or sword. So running at the ring would really seek to develop accuracy in hitting a target, and also at high speed as well. So the participants would take it in turns to run along the tilt yard, and they would take aim with their lance at a ring that was suspended from a post. So this replaced the opponent, and it was a genuine contest.
Right.
Okay. So we have lots of letters and papers. One of the Venetian ambassadors, actually, in 1509, so right at the start of Henry's reign, he writes home that the king had been tilting at the ring at the Palace of Westminster. So it's early in his reign that Henry really starts to train for these joustings. So it's very clear that he wants to throw himself into this sport. And indeed, jousting does require, you know, upper body arm strength, daily workouts to build up the shoulders and arms, vital to jousting. And so it doesn't really matter whether or not you're a young or an old man, you know, to sustain this physical perfection, it does require a lot of effort on Henry's part. So even though, yes, he's very tall, he has in some ways a body that is fitting for tilt yard, this is also the product of a lot of hard work and training.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, do we know, were the lances different weights, like for different people, if you know what I mean, or was it just one sort of standard size?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite difficult because we don't have a lot of surviving lances available. There are some in the Tower of London and also the Royal Armourers in Leeds as well. But I mean, these were incredibly heavy that these men had to lift. And also for a sustained period, as well as controlling a horse, and also the impact of that hit as well. So these men really had to be quite physical and warriors, really, to build themselves up for this training.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of hard work, basically. Now, I remember reading that I think Henry VII kind of shielded his son from this kind of physical and vigorous activity, obviously afraid that he'd lose his only heir. So normally, when would boys start training for? So you mentioned the shooting. What was it called? Turning the ring, shooting the ring. I've lost it now.
Yeah, tilting the ring.
So when would they have started that kind of training? Do we have that recorded?
Yeah. So we have a lot of recordings of young men that are riding. It would first start out with riding horses.
Yeah.
And obviously, being a skilled horseman is an essential part of jousting in particular, because you have to be able to guide your horse to run head on at another horse. So that would start quite young, probably between the ages of about 9 and 10.
Okay.
And there are lots of instances that we see in the letters and papers where we know that young men in Henry's reign, so some of the famous jousters such as Charles Brandon, were sent off to like a nightly practicing school, if you like, where they're trained by expert jousters who've retired.
Right.
So we have instances where these men are together training, and we see lots of training instances in Henry VII's reign as well. And then it's almost as though they graduate. So by the time they get to Henry VIII's reign, they are now themselves professional jousters.
Fascinating. I love all the detail. Thank you. Now, I think it was David Starkey that referred to Tudor jousters as the rock stars of the day. So tell us about Henry's jousting companions. You mentioned one earlier, Charles Brandon. What was his relationship with this group of men?
So Henry, we know a lot about his relationship with women, and
yes,
that's really well documented, and everything that we read is all about Henry's relationship with his wives. But actually, the closest men in Henry's reign are really his jousting companions. These are the men that he sleeps with in his privy chamber, that feed him, that dress him. And these are the men that he spends majority of his time with. So one of his closest companions is actually his brother-in-law, Charles Brandon.
Mm-hmm.
And he really is, I guess, the David Beckham of the jousting world.
Yeah.
He's very much an expert jouster. Henry loves to tilt against Brandon because he's so good. He makes Henry look good because the matches are always quite exciting. They're quite ruthless, and on occasion it seems that Brandon may have manipulated the scores to make it look like Henry won by a very small margin.
Right.
And obviously you want to beat the best man, and Brandon is the best man at court. And also another indirect prize of these jousting tournaments is that men do very well from them in terms of their political and career and also status. So Brandon becomes a Knight of the Garter, he becomes a Duke of Suffolk. This is an incredible award because there's only two dukes that are made during Henry's reign, and one of them is an inherited post, and it's Brandon who is created from scratch, really.
Yes.
And there's nothing really that he does beyond his jousting career at this stage that makes him worthy of this prize. So that just really tells us how seriously Henry took this competition, how much he valued it. And we have other men such as Henry Norris, again, who is a long-standing jouster during Henry's reign. He actually manages to joust into his late 50s.
Yeah.
This becomes a bit of a problem actually for Henry, and there's a lot of jousting jealousy with Henry Norris, and he ends up being one of the men that is accused alongside Anne Boleyn. And perhaps this is because Henry Norris is continuing to joust when Henry is unable. We also have men such as William Compton. He's the first man that Henry enters into the tilt yard with in disguise.
Right.
And he becomes Henry's groom of the stool, as does Henry Norris, actually. And these are the men that would wipe the king's backside.
That's
a very
right.
intimate position, and yet these are jousters. So they have roles that perhaps we've been overlooking for many years. But these men do really advance their status from taking part in tournaments.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, when you think about it. So these jousting companions were basically guaranteed access to the king, which I suppose is incredibly important. And that post that you mentioned, Groom of the Stool, also guaranteed access to the king, very intimate access, as you've pointed out. So this is all, possibility where you can influence the king, where you can advance your family.
Yeah.
So super important, amazing stuff, yeah. All right, so I want to move forward a little bit in the timeline. So Henry VIII was involved in two quite serious jousting accidents, one in 1524 and one in 1536. Could you talk to us a little bit about these two events?
Yes, so as we know, jousting is still incredibly dangerous during this period. And it's in 1524 when Henry's actually competing against his favourite tiltyard companion, Brandon, who we've just spoke about, in a match. And what seems to have happened is that Brandon sets off down the tiltyard before the king has actually lowered his visor.
Right.
Now, because of the constricted view of a jousting helm, Brandon wouldn't have been necessarily able to see, especially from such a distance, that the king's visor hadn't been lowered. And as we know, Brandon is seen to make very accurate hits on the bodies and head of his opponents. So at the last minute, he raises his lance and he strikes it, and it hits the king in the face.
Gosh.
Filling him with splinters. And this is exceptionally dangerous because actually Henry II died from a similar jousting collision in 1559.
Right.
So
right.
Henry has this accident in 1524, and he is knocked off his horse. And straight away, you can imagine everyone sort of running over to the king, and they're looking across, and Brandon's obviously looking panicked. Actually, Henry, in quite heroic fashion, gets up from this and recovers quite quickly, and actually runs a further six times against Brandon. So, you know, perhaps Brandon's lucky that he has this relationship with the king. Somebody else might not have been as fortunate.
I was just thinking that. I thought if anyone can get away with hitting the king in the head, it was Charles Brandon.
Yeah, it's Brandon. By 1536, Henry doesn't recover well from this accident, like he does in 1524. So this is quite a serious jousting accident that he has. He's actually riding in his tilt yard. And there's actually a lot of misbelief about this. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot written that this is a jousting accident. Actually, there's no recorded tournament in which this takes place. What we actually know is that the king is just riding his tilt yard, and it might be that he's training. And when knights were training, they weren't necessarily always kitted out in their full jousting helms. So the king has a collision. He falls off his horse. The horse actually falls on top of him, and it causes a 2-hour loss of consciousness.
Yes.
And this really is the beginning of the end for Henry in terms of his jousting career. He is badly injured. He has an infected leg. We know it really troubles him across the course of his reign. And we've got letters that talk about humours that have opened up on his leg. Even into sort of 1537, there's 10 or 12 days of this humour that stifles him, and he can't speak, and he's black in the face, and he seems to be in great danger. So he's lucky to be alive, but the effect on his body is very apparent, and it definitely marks the end of his jousting career.
That's so fascinating, Emma, because I've never read that he was perhaps training and not in an actual, I've always just assumed he was competing against someone. So that's a really fascinating point you've brought up there. Now, when would he, because I've also read that the horse may have been in full armor as well. So would, if in a training situation, would you have been in full armor and your horse in full armor?
Not always necessarily you would have been in full armour when you were running at the ring. The sources don't mention that there was a tournament or that there was a joust taking place in the January. It seems likely that Henry was training for a tournament that was going to take place in the May, which was the May Day tournament of 1536. So what we have from the sources is that Henry is riding in his tilt yard, that he's training the tilt yard, and this accident occurs.
It's really interesting. And normally, if it was a competition, would the horse have been in full armor and the knight in full armor?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, okay. he probably would have died in that instance, given the weight of his horse. But yeah, it's definitely something that we need to maybe do some more research into and find the real details. We've only got a few different recorded manuscripts that have been left about this event.
Yeah, it is interesting because I know one source, as you mentioned, says he was sort of out cold, or a couple of them say, I think, for 2 hours. And then there's a third one, I think, that basically doesn't even mention that he was, you know, knocked out. So it's confusing, but it's such an interesting incident. I agree with you. I think we should, you know, look into that a bit further. All right. So what happens, Emma, when a king who loves sport is obviously completely obsessed with vigorous sport and displaying his manhood in these spectacles? What happens when a man who loves jousting is no longer able to take part? How does this affect not only obviously his physical appearance, but his mood and his manhood? Could you sort of talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, so definitely it has really obvious physical effects.
Yes.
Henry's lack of exercise and the lack of physical training, it causes him to be drastically overweight in his later years. There's a lot of conspicuous consumption at Henry's reign, and we know that he has a great appetite for rich foods in particular. And if we look at his armour towards the end of his reign, we see that impact that has had on his expanding physique. So his armour from 1540 shows that the king has a 51 inch waist and a 54 and a half inch chest. And if we compare that with armour from the start of his reign, from 1515, we have some silver and engraved armour of Henry on a horse.
Yes.
And his waist has actually grown by about 16 inches and his chest by 12 inches. So it gives a really good depiction of the king's physique in the final stages of his life.
Yeah.
Clearly, not being able to embody that ideal physical physique that pertains to a very particular form of knightly masculinity, it means that Henry can't really lay claim to his status as a manly or knightly king anymore. And so it seems that he goes through a bit of a midlife crisis, is the best way to describe it, in the late 1540s. And he returns to fighting war with France. And this is an attempt to sort of recapture his manhood and to prove that he is still a man. Obviously, Henry in jousting, it's a very active sport. Whereas with warfare, there's lots of different roles that you can partake in.
Mm-hmm.
So you can stand from the back, you can be there on horseback. You don't necessarily have to be in the thick of the battle to be a part of a warfare activity. So Henry can take on a different role, but he definitely tries to recapture that youth. And it's interesting that he does that right at the end of his reign when he can no longer joust.
Yeah, it seems like that, you know, the accident and his inability to joust really just shattered that sort of image that he had of himself as a chivalrous medieval knight. Like, that was just completely destroyed, wasn't it?
And exactly.
It looks like he went and replaced jousting with warfare, which is also quite an interesting thing. All right. That's, yeah, amazing. All right. So a marble slab marks Henry VIII and Jane Seymour's final resting place in the choir of St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle. However, this was only intended to be temporary while a really grand monument was completed. Now, could you talk to us about what Henry had planned for himself and what it tells us about how he wanted us to remember him and what he thought about his kingship and I suppose manhood in general? You've touched a little bit on this, but could you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, so what Henry had planned is very different to what we have currently in St. George's Chapel. So he planned this vast edifice of himself. It was going to be ornamented with oriental stones, resplendent with white marble pillars, and there was going to be gilded bronze angels, four life-size images of the king and queen, about 134 figures surrounding it. Of the prophets, the apostles, St. George, St. John the Baptist. And this was all going to be topped, importantly, by this life-size gilded statue of Henry on horseback, which is just extraordinary. It would have approximately cost, into sort of the modern equivalent of today, about £6,009,000.
Wow.
Had Henry's plans been realised, this would have been truly a magnificent structure to behold, and far grander than the tomb of Henry's parents, and far more ornate than any of the resting places of any European monarchs.
Right.
And I think it's interesting in particular that, you know, Henry wants to emphasise this knightly masculinity, that he wants himself to be on horseback, in armour in particular, as part of this effigy, really modelling himself on the medieval knight. And this is how he wants remembered. And his burial tomb was intended to reflect that. If you think about burial tombs, such as of his father, Henry VII, sort of laid down in quite a passive position. Arms resting in prayer, quite a religious image, quite a pious image. This is the complete opposite of what Henry wants. Henry wants to be on horseback as if he's almost about to take off from his effigy. So very active and a very knightly display. And that is how Henry saw himself being remembered. And it's quite interesting as well that he draws up this design in 1527, because at this point in the late 1520s is where he still hasn't managed to secure himself a male heir to the throne. So there are questions surrounding his potency, his marriage to Catherine, and so it's interesting then at this point that Henry decides that he's going to be determined to remember himself in a particular way and have others remember himself in that way by having this very manly structure built for him.
Yes, and at that huge cost, it's little wonder that his children never finished the monument for him. That's extraordinary. I'm a bit sad, though, that we don't have it to look upon today, but anyway. Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so we definitely know he wanted to be remembered as this remembered as this active kind of knight rather than anything else. It's so interesting. All right, Emma, this has been such a great conversation, but we are at the point in the episode of playing our little game of 10 to go. So are you ready to play that?
Definitely, I'm ready.
Fabulous. All right, we'll start easy question. What was the last book that you bought, if you can remember, otherwise that you read?
I think it was actually, surprise, surprise, it was a tournament one, Tournaments and Pageants. I forget the author now as well.
Oh, that's okay. That sounds good. Don't worry.
Richard Barber.
Oh, Richard Barber.
That's the one that I looked at.
I'm writing it down. I'm always adding books to my list. Thank you.
Juliet Baker, I think, and Richard Barber.
Okay. Thank you. So what are two items that are on your bucket list?
I haven't yet been to Windsor Castle. Speaking about Henry's burial tomb, I've not been to St. George's Chapel, so I'd love to go there and see the burial tomb of him and also Edward IV. So that's definitely on there. And I would like to visit a few more medieval castles in European cities as well. So I've got quite a long list of ones that I want to visit, particularly in sort of Germany, France, Spain.
Yeah, there's so many to see in Europe, isn't there? All right, so what's a movie that always makes you cry, regardless of how many times you watch it? Or it could be a series if you're into. Or maybe you're not a cry like me.
For me, to be honest, it's usually a movie that involves any dog or animals.
I think that's what another guest said. Yeah, they said the same thing.
Yeah. I have a pug. He's actually quite famous in the history world because he comes along with me to lots of English heritage sites. And actually, he's been on a few Twitter accounts being held by medieval reenactors. So, yeah, something like Marley and Me would get me every time.
I actually think that's the exact same movie my last guest said, which is really interesting. All right. What is your favourite comfort food?
Probably Chinese food.
Okay. That sounds good. Yeah. All right. What do you do to recharge?
For me, I really enjoy swimming and exercise. I know that's not everyone's cup of tea, but for me, I really enjoy just switching off. Did lots of exercise during my research PhD, so that really helped.
Excellent. Very good. Describe your ideal Saturday night.
For me, probably a night in and just watching a really good box set. I get really addicted to different Netflix box sets.
Yeah.
And at the moment, I've been watching Victoria on ITV. So I've been going through all of those. And then I want to start the new one on Catherine of Aragon.
Yes. Is that the Stars one, the new Stars one, you mean, or another one?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. It's not on, you have to pay to see it here in Australia. So I thought I'll just wait and see.
I'm just finishing Game of Thrones as well. So I'm waiting for that one.
I know. Yeah, me too. I am. I'm, you know. holding my breath waiting for the last episode, but anyway, we'll discuss that later. All right, what's your favorite kind of music?
I quite like, I guess, sort of light sort of rock or indie music, I guess. Okay. I quite like artists like George Ezra at the moment. I really like him, just easy listening.
Yeah, that sounds good. Let's see, what is one of the best gifts or the most memorable gifts that you've received?
I actually got a really good gift this Christmas, going back to the pug. It was actually a book that was created, and it inserted Pal in there, which is named the pug, and myself. And it was a book that was designed all about me and Pal, and there was lots of things in there about history as well. So it's like an original book that was made.
How fabulous is that? That's a fantastic gift, something you can treasure for a long time. I love that. All right. For the people that know you well, is there something that I suppose your friends don't know about you, a kind of, you know, hidden little thing? It might be a vice that you have, eating chocolate at night, I don't know.
Gosh, what don't they know? A lot of people don't know that I was a dancer for many, many years before I did anything history-based. So I was torn between going into sort of theatre or history. And I actually went for history because I just saw it as like a long-term sort of passion. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I danced from being about 3 years old, and I've kept it quiet because as soon as you say that, many people will say, oh, can you do me some ballet? Can you do me dance?
Oh, there you go. You did have something. All right. And lucky last, when you were a child, and maybe this is the dance, I don't know, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, when I was younger, I definitely wanted to be on the West End. Oh, that was my dream. I wanted to be in a musical or in a play and just like performing. So I've always enjoyed that side of it.
All right, lucky, very lucky last thing is our Tudor takeaway. So this is just a little gem, a little something for us to check out after the podcast episode, maybe a website, a book, a song, anything. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Do you know, I'm actually not ashamed to say that I'm quite an avid reader of Tudor fiction novels.
Yeah,
So yeah, the obsession just continues, as well as the Netflix dramas and TV shows. But I absolutely love, I watch Wolf Hall.
Oh, yes.
I love Hilary Mantel's books, and I'll even read things like Susanna Dern. I've read her books, which are really good, in Tudor fiction courts. Philippa Gregory, always really entertaining on holiday. I've actually read books dating back to like Jean Plaidley, who was writing like in the 1960s.
Yeah, they're great, aren't they?
Yeah. But I just love, I think some of the work that I do with tournament sources can be quite patchy. And I love that imagination that they bring and that creativity to sort of piece their stories together. So for me, yeah, anything sort of Tudor court novels, I really like to imagine all the conversations that were taking place between Henry and Brandon and on the tilt yard.
Definitely. So what's one of your favourites that you might suggest people go out and have a read of if they haven't yet? So many to choose from.
One of the ones that I actually reread recently, was Jean Plaidley one, was Murder Most Royal.
Oh yes.
It's not particularly about tournaments, but it's got three different perspectives in it from the Queens, which I really enjoyed.
Well, there you go, everyone. There's one for us to pick up, Murder Most Royal. You can normally get secondhand copies of that, which is nice. Emma, it's been an absolute pleasure. I have certainly learned a lot, and I think that everyone else would have learned a lot about jousting and tournaments. So I thank you very much for your time, and I hope that we can speak again in the future.
Definitely. Thank you very much for having me. It's been really fun.
All right. Thanks so much. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon. Thank you.
Thank you.